Scott from the Darling Downs Institute of Advanced Education in Toowoomba. The topic that I was asked to speak about was entitled The Anti-God Philosophy and Evolution. I'm a little bit dubious about the title of the topic to start off with. I'm not too sure about using the expression an anti-God philosophy. It's a very odd sort of term. It gives the notion that somehow behind it all there is somebody who is sitting there and saying this morning, how can my philosophy be anti-God today? I'm not going to deal with things that are quite as blatant or as clear-cut as that, because that would involve dealing with the very few who have seen their work as being something to do with a deliberately anti-theistic or anti-Christian view. I'm much more concerned with the fact that there's been a very large trend among a whole lot of thinkers over a very long period of time, the end result of which is something that you might call an anti-God position. But it's rather a semi-conscious one rather than a deliberate one. From the very beginning, philosophy, in a sense, has always been something that, from a Christian point of view, has been a very dubious sort of quantity. If you go back to the ancient Greeks, to the very beginning of philosophy, the early Greek philosophers were known more for anything else, or distinguished even in their own society for anything else than this. They were people who were trying to understand the world by the use of pure human reason, and they were people who were searching to establish an understanding based on human freedom, on what you might call human autonomy. Man, the free thinking being, not dependent on anything else to direct his thinking. The very first person that generally appears in the philosophy books as the first philosopher was a chap called Thales, who lived at Miletus back about 600 BC. And it's interesting to see the sort of things that Thales did as a philosopher. Well, the stories they tell about him anyway. The stories told about Thales include the following ones. He's supposed to have predicted an eclipse of the sun. He was very fortunate the day he predicted his eclipse, because the eclipse occurred on a day when there's a large battle about to be waged. And both armies noticed the sun disappear. They thought the gods were angry and they both went home. So they got talking afterwards and somebody said, that fellow Thales down in Miletus said that would happen. He's supposed to have calculated or found out how to calculate the distance of a ship at sea, presumably by some sort of similar triangles thing. There's a story told that he went in for weather forecasting. Now, I don't know what success he had, because I'm not too sure what success we have in that particular field, but the story goes that somebody said to him, philosophy is a waste of time, and philosophers are people who'd be better to do something practical. So what he did, he predicted, using his great intellect, that next year was going to be a very good season for the olive crop. And he went out to the island of Chios, so the story goes, and took out an option on all the olive presses. Come the autumn, there was a bumper crop. He didn't bother cashing in and making a lot of money. He just said, well, look, philosophers could make a lot of money if they wanted to, but they're not interested in that. Nice story. Some of the early Christian writers came up with a worse story about him later on, that poor Thales came to a sticky end. He was walking along staring at the stars and fell down a well. Now, that's part of the whole mythology, you see, of what philosophers are like. However, I hope it's only mythology. However, what is it about Thales? First of all, he tried to explain things around him in fairly natural terms. The most puzzling story about him is that he said everything is made of water. Try and work that out sometime. Everything is made of water. Doesn't sound very helpful. Until you realise that he was probably the first person or amongst the first people to actually ask that question, what is everything made of? Traditionally, the Greeks had believed, of course, that there were the gods on Mount Olympus who'd caused various happenings in the world by their actions in the world. And now here's a fellow who's going beyond all the myths, all the legends, all the stories of the gods, and saying, yes, all right, we don't know about these stories, but as a matter of fact, what's everything made of? He's asking a question in terms of human reason, and his answer is a question that sounds reasonable. Why does it sound reasonable? You get some water out of the river Meander, which is not far from Miletus. It comes down through some limestone hills. You get some water out of that river and put it in a saucepan and boil it like mad till it's all gone. Well, what's happened to the water? Most of it's turned into air, hasn't it? It's gone. You can't see it, can you? And what's left? That white scaly stuff you get when you boil hard water dry. Boiler scale. See? Some of it turned into dirt, the rest of it's turned into air. Everything's made of water. Simple. You get some real dry soil. Don't care how dry it is. Stick it on the side on a stone beside a hot fire, and what happens? You see moisture coming out of it. Huh? Everything's made of water. Quite simple. No puzzles. Very simple explanation. You know, I mean, ice and water are the same thing, aren't they? Snow and fog. And isn't a rock just something like ice, only more compressed, and maybe you have to do something else to it to turn it back to water again? It's not as silly as it sounds. But the point is, it's a natural explanation. It's one which appeals to you because it appeals to things you can see around you at a very fairly elementary level. For a long time, the Greek philosophers, these people who are seekers after wisdom, lovers of wisdom, the word means, were concentrating on natural science things, questions like that. But later on, the shift changed. They changed direction. They changed instead to putting much more emphasis on questions of ethics, on questions of what is the good society like? How should we live? I mean, if you lived in a society like ancient Greece where they had 2,000 or 3,000 independent little city-states, each one with its own political system, and everybody arguing that theirs is the best, I suppose the question, what is the ideal society, comes home to you a bit. You know, I mean, if you went from here to Ipswich and found yourself in an entirely different culture with a different sort of government, and you went from, and on the way you passed through Bundamba that was independent and had its own government and its own system, quite different again, and you knew that somewhere a bit further out of Gatton there was an entirely different society with a king. One's a republic, one's got a king, one's got harsh laws, one's got soft laws, etc. It'd be incredible. And the question was brought home to them, you know, what is a good society? So they started to ask these questions. And again, in trying to ask these questions, the basic principle was the correct answer will be the answer that appears reasonable to a reasonable person. Beautifully summed up by one of the Greek sophists of the 5th century, one of the wandering teachers, a chap called Protagoras. Now, boy, there was a fella for you. He got expelled from Athens at the age of 98 for political agitation. Protagoras said, "Man is the measure of all things." Man is the measure of all things. Human reason is the ultimate test. And that became, if you like, the basic assumption running right down for philosophy, from then till now. Take any proposition, any belief system, any idea that anybody has, and let us subject it to reason and think it through reasonably, rationally. Human reason, the judge in all things. And of course, right at the start, there was a puzzle. What happens if two apparently reasonable people come up with two opposite points of view on something? Who is to judge which human reason is the most reasonable? And that was basically the problem they couldn't settle. That's what's kept philosophers in a job ever since. So, right from the very beginning, in a sense, philosophy's had this orientation. Now, you look at that and compare that with the biblical position that man is a creature responsible to a creator and to whom the creator has given a word, which is a word of direction. And if you like to look at Romans 1 sometime, you find there a very interesting notion of the consequences of human rebellion against the Creator's word and the deliberate or semi-deliberate turning away from the word of the Creator. The consequences of that. Although they knew him as God, they wouldn't recognise him as God. And this seems to be a basic element right through the thinking of philosophy, certainly. Right, now, let's do a bit of a skip of a couple of thousand years. I mean, there's no problem about skipping over time. Towards the 17th century, the time of the rise of modern science, the age of Galileo and a little bit later of Newton. For those who are interested, Newton was born the day after Galileo died. If anybody's got any strange theories of transmigration of the soul, well, you know, it's an interesting starting point. In the 17th century, a tremendous explosion of scientific discovery, an enormous explosion of discovery. You think about it. In 1600, the circulation of the blood was not understood. It was generally thought that it went, was pumped in and out like a tide. Every time your heart pumped, it goes out, back and out and back. That was the theory. Well, Aristotle said, it's only a cut of vein and doesn't it squirt out, so it must be going out and back. That was 1600. In 1600, nobody had managed yet to solve Aristotle's problem. What was Aristotle's problem? The great problem of physics. Why does an arrow work? You say, well, who wants to worry about that? It does, doesn't it? But you see, Aristotle had a theory of physics, a very simple theory, a basic theory of mechanics, based on the simple principle, if you try to drag this across there, the harder you drag it, the faster it goes, and when you stop pushing it, it stops. That's true, isn't it? You try to drag a stone up the Acropolis in Athens to build a new temple. You pull and the stone moves. You stop and the stone stops, right? Common sense. And so you develop a basic principle. Velocity is proportional to force. The greater the force you put on it, the faster it moves. If you stop pulling, it stops. I mean, any slave that's dragged a stone up the side of the Acropolis is well aware of that. So there's our rule, right? The harder you push it, the faster it goes. But what happens to the arrow? You put it on the bowstring and you pull it back and you go, chomp, and what happens? The arrow leaves the string and there's nothing pushing it. According to that theory, what should it do? Aristotle couldn't figure that out. There's nothing pushing it. What makes it go? He had an explanation. He thought the air that the tip of the arrow displaced ran around the back and pushed it from behind. That's not a bad theory, except that according to that theory, the arrow ought to go forever. It's even more difficult. People couldn't work it out. It literally led to a stalling of mechanics for 2,000 years. In 1600, nobody had solved it. The nearest they'd got was a medieval chap called Bernadette in Paris. He had a very interesting idea that when you pull the string back and let it go, there's an invisible weightless fluid called impetus ran out of the string into the arrow. And then as the arrow sped along, the impetus slowly leaked out. When it was all gone, the arrow fell. And don't laugh, it's not so different from an idea of kinetic energy. And he called it impetus and thought it was a fluid. Well, that's 1600. In the year 1600, a very interesting appointment was made in Central Europe to the Roman Austrian Emperor. The Emperor in his court, shifting between Prague and Vienna that year, appointed a new person to the court, a chap called Johannes Kepler. And most of us have heard of Kepler, the great astronomer. You know what Kepler was appointed as? He was appointed as court astrologer to cast the horoscope so the emperor and his court would know what was the right day to attempt the right bits of business and what was a good day to start a war and a good day to conclude a treaty. That's in 1600. Nobody knew what made the tides work in 1600. There were some strange guesses. You think what's happened between 1600 and 1700. By 1700, not long after 1600, Harvey published his work on the circulation of the blood. Kepler, astrologer though he was, worked out in detail the orbit of the planet Mars. In Italy, Galileo worked out the answer to Aristotle's puzzle, introducing the concept of acceleration and the concepts of friction to explain what happened to the chair when I was dragging it, and fitting both the chair and the arrow into one sort of explanation. About the same time, a chap called Gehrig in Germany did his experiments with air pumps, demonstrated all that work with vacuums, with the evacuated sphere that the teams of horses couldn't pull apart. At about that time, a fellow called Pascal in France was discovering Pascal's principle. You don't know what Pascal's principle is? Well, the next time you put your foot on the brake of a car, be thankful that Pascal's principle is still a principle. It's the basis of any hydraulic system. At about that stage too, a chap called Torricelli in Italy was discovering the Torricellian vacuum, which led to the whole notion of the barometer and the measure of air pressure. A few years after that in England, Boyle did work with improving kinds of pumps and shortly thereafter discovered Boyle's law, one of the basic principles of gases, the volume pressure relationship of gases. At that time, Isaac Newton was just starting on his tremendous amount of work, which led to a beautiful tying in of a whole lot of other explanations. I'll come back to Newton in a minute, but all of Newtonian science. One of Newton's sort of partial rivals was a chap called Hooke, who was the fellow who discovered the basic laws of elasticity. Thereafter, you could use a spring balance with some confidence, because Hooke's law tells you, you know, what the proportionality was. Another associate of both Hooke and Newton was a chap called Halley, the astronomer who got involved in identifying recurrent appearances of comets, Halley's Comet, named after him, because he identified and predicted its return. A tremendous century for change in all sorts of things, in scientific knowledge. By 1700, there was a sort of a new world. What was this new world of scientific thinking like? It was a world in which there was a great deal of growing confidence in the capacity for human beings to understand the world. A tremendous degree of confidence that humans could understand things, providing they stuck to the things that they could handle. If you like, knowledge was starting to split up into two kinds. The things that you find very hard to think about, like theology, because you don't seem to be able to do experiments in theology. And things like the sciences, where you can get down and carry out experiments, and by looking at it as a human being, without any assumptions, any presuppositions, any prior ideas at all, you can sit down and you can make real discoveries. The 18th century was in many ways a century of optimism. Particularly in France, the 18th century is often referred to as the Age of Enlightenment. Not quite sure in what sense they meant enlightenment, but I guess enlightenment meant now we can think as free human beings. A couple of examples. The French philosopher, literary critic and so on, Voltaire, the man who criticised, who attacked all sorts of atrocities and infamies, after one of his slogans, l'écraser l'infâme, blot out the infamy. But for all that, a fellow who was determined to be free from any sort of anything else than just using common sense, reason. Let's be reasonable and rational and not commit ourselves to anything other than that. On Voltaire's tomb, the people of Paris inscribed this: "He taught us to be free." It's very interesting, a few years after that, the time of the French Revolution, they actually installed, or Robespierre tried to install, an official worship of a goddess of reason, as a sort of a state goddess, state religion, the worship of reason. It's interesting to see Voltaire's attitude towards traditional theism. He did believe in God, but he didn't believe too much of what any of the theologians had to tell him. Looking at what the theologians were like in France in the 18th century, who can blame him? But on the other hand, if one looks at the rather sour comments that he made, it's rather interesting to see the free, autonomous man who was prepared to look God in the face and laugh, as it were. This was the image. Voltaire's statement about prayer: "I have only made but one prayer to God. It was a very simple one. Lord, make all my enemies look ridiculous. God answered my prayer." Right? The Age of Enlightenment. An age when, also in France, Diderot was publishing his great encyclopedia, that sort of massive encyclopedia of human knowledge. Knowledge collected basically by human beings, by the evidence of their senses, knowledge based on reason. Very interesting age. An age in which reason was well and truly enthroned as the ultimate. One last sort of example. The English poet Alexander Pope, early in the century, in his essay on man, Alexander Pope sort of appealing to people, don't worry about things you can't understand, look, there's so much that human reason can handle. And those famous lines, "Then know thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man." So stay with the things you can understand and the sky's the limit. An interesting age. An age out of which, as I'll point out in a minute or two ago, in a few minutes' time, arose the sort of beginnings of the thinking that has helped to enshrine Darwinian evolution as a cornerstone of modern thought. Let's go back a little bit. I mentioned Newton. Isaac Newton was a very interesting man, a very complex figure, a fellow who believed that he would be remembered in future ages for two things. He thought that everybody would remember him as a very concerned scholar on the question of the interpretation of sacred prophecy. He wrote several books on prophecy. He also hoped to be remembered forever as the master of the Royal Mint, has been an excellent controller of the Royal Mint, and as being one of the people responsible for the introduction of milled edges on coins, because smart alecks were filing the edges off the sovereigns and using the gold filings to make another sovereign on the side. And he was one of the people who helped to introduce the milled edge on coins. He thought he'd be famous for milled edges on coins and for books on prophecy. Did you ever know that Isaac Newton wrote on those two, was interested in those things? Funny, isn't it? So you don't always become famous for what you think you're going to be famous for. But also, of course, we think of Newton as the scientist. What was there about Newton's science that seems so interesting? Two things. First of all, Newton based his science very largely on an understanding of the complex in terms of very simple forces. The genius of Newtonian mechanics is that he managed to explain a whole lot of very different things in terms of some very simple principles. You know the story about Newton sitting under the garden, sitting under the apple tree during the plague, when he left Cambridge and went to the garden in Woolsthorpe, and he's sitting under the tree and the apple hit him on the head and he said, "Hooray, I discovered gravity." Not quite. What he did, he deduced something about the forces operating on a falling apple, and from that managed to show how those forces were the same as the forces that caused all sorts of other things. My private theory is there was a wind blowing the day he was sitting under the apple tree. The apple didn't hit him on the head, it missed him. That's only my guess. Now what sense does that make? Right? The apple's up there. Now if the apple's going to fall, what should it do? Clunk. But today the wind was blowing and it went over there. See? Now, the $64,000 question is, what would happen if there was a much bigger wind blowing? Well, the apple would go further, wouldn't it? How far would it go? If you had a big enough wind blowing, a really howling wind, could it literally go that far that the curvature of the surface of the earth becomes significant? Could you have the apple going so fast sideways that it falls around the earth? That's the question. And that's basically what Newton did. He showed that he showed by some not terribly complicated calculations that you can show that that's roughly what the moon's doing. It's up there, it's been given a bit of a shove in one direction, and it's falling around the earth, and will keep falling around the earth. Isn't that what you do when you launch a satellite? You send the rocket up, you point the rocket in the right direction up there, chomp, and it fires the satellite out. And off it goes, round and round, always falling around and never hitting the ground. The fact that it needs a sideways kick at 20,000 miles an hour, so it doesn't matter. I mean, that's what's involved. That was Newton. He tied all of those different things together. The moon moving around the earth moving around the sun, the pull of the tides, the apple falling off the tree, all beautifully explained in terms of some very, very simple basic principles. All tied together. Now, this did two things. First of all, it produced a tremendous confidence in the power of human reason. That poem that goes, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, then there was light." Very extreme. The other thing is that Newton himself was a Christian, a theist, who well and truly believed that God had created it. Because what gave the moon its sideways shove in the first place? But Newton didn't ask that question. As a scientist, he concentrated on what he could explain by means of his observations, by means of his calculations. He didn't go beyond that. He left it at that and sort of said, well, God created it and I'm describing how it happens. In fact, he took the view that one of his mottos, hypotheses non fingo. I do not make up hypotheses. I just think God's thoughts after it. Well, that's right. Well, that was what he thought he was doing. He was working out how God had the thing. In other words, God is the great watchmaker, and Newton is the man who's discovered how the watch runs. Within 100 years of Newton's time, the sort of science that he'd started, this notion that you can explain things in terms of the simple, in terms of very simple basic principles, had taken a step further. By 1800, you get people who are now trying to explain, well, how did it all begin in the first place? Can we explain that without any appeal to an outside creator? What sort of mechanisms put the solar system there in the first place? And the very good example, of course, Pierre Laplace, the French mathematician, who worked out the nebula hypothesis. You know, the mass of hot gas that swirls around and around in a circle, and eventually the planets are sort of spun off it and cooled down. Pierre Laplace worked out the mathematics and showed how the mass of hot gas rotating could become the solar system. It explains why you've got a big planet in the middle and small ones that's close to the sun and out at the edge. It worked pretty well. He worked all this out. Laplace was introduced to Napoleon. Napoleon, very interested in mathematics, the ex-artillery officer, always interested in things mathematical, very fascinated, and said to him, yeah, that's great, but where does God fit in? Laplace says, sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. But the funny part about it is that Laplace was a fairly good Catholic. He used to go to church quite regularly, went to Mass quite regularly. You see what he'd done? As a scientist, he's thinking about the things. He's thinking, as a scientist, his job as a scientist is to explain things in terms of natural causes that he could see happening around him. In terms of the known laws of physics, he would try to explain the universe. As a believer in God, he believes that God made it, and the two worlds in his own mind were quite divorced. Simple as that. Now, Newton's science, and the science of those mathematicians who followed him, tended to do this. It tended to lead to a lovely split, whereby the job of the scientist is to explain as much as possible in terms of the known laws which can be currently observed. And let's see how, in this age of enlightenment, the 18th century, the age of confidence in human reason, another step forward takes place. In Scotland, towards the end of the 18th century, the geologist Hutton, James Hutton, the farmer from Berwick, who also became a fairly successful geologist, developed the principle that we know today as the principle of uniformitarianism. The principle that what made the earth like it is now, geologically, must have been the result of forces much the same as the ones we currently see operating. Right? It's consistent with the Newton model. You explain the unknown in terms of the known. We are going to explain the world, how it got to be like this, in terms of present forces. What has made the earth like it is now are the forces that are operating now. What geologic forces were operating? Well, there's erosion, and you can see river meanderings, you can see weathering of rocks, some slow upheaval along a coastline, of the sea as more water carries more salt down to the sea. These are going to be the sorts of things by which we are going to explain everything that's happened in the past. That's how the world got to be the way it is. We can explain the past in terms of present forces. Now you say, hey, but wait a minute, that runs contrary to the whole Christian point of view. It's rather funny. Towards the end of his life, Hutton was attacked. Somebody realised where this was heading. And several groups, including the Royal Irish Academy, accused him of what they call practical atheism. Poor man had a nervous breakdown, died. He honestly didn't realise where his own presuppositions were taking him, where his own view was taking him. He was shocked when he found himself being charged with practical atheism. What he was doing, you see, was saying, right, well, taking what we've got now, the fact that human reason can think this through, these are the forces operating, let's see what made the world like that. And of course, if you ask the question, how did the world get created, and you phrase the question in terms of how did it get here, caused by present forces, well, of course, the only thing you're going to find in the past are the forces the same as the ones that's operating now. You're not going to find any others, because that's the way you ask the question. How did it get like this? You know, it's a bit like you go look at a billiard table. And there's some billiard balls lying on the billiard table. And somebody, you assume that somebody's been playing a game. And you look and you say, oh, you know, gee, you know, really, you know, that's a very strange position to finish up in. Huh? Well, how did he get like that? So you look at the ball, you think, well, he must have hit it from here, and it's got across there and in behind there. That's the only way he could get a ball into that corner. But you're assuming that he's been playing the game. Supposing he came down before and deliberately set them out like that to puzzle you. Or supposing a child has been playing with them beforehand, right? You assume the force that you know, which is a normal game of billiards or snooker, huh? On the table. Somebody, but you've got no guarantee. It could have been any one of 100 things got it like that. Is it? Now, the interesting thing is that from the time of Hutton onwards, nobody seems to have much asked this question in geology. Because after all, once you go past the question of present forces and presently known things operating, you're moving into a realm that suggests that the scientist's answer is not a complete answer, and you're moving into a realm that suggests that maybe man's mind is not the measure of all things. Because the only way you could know about that billiard table would be to be there before you got there. If you got there at 2:30 in the afternoon and the balls were on a table in a certain pattern, the only way you could really know how they got to be like that was to be there before you got there. Am I trying to get it? And of course, Hutton's work then, a bit later, was taken over into the work, particularly by the work of Sir Charles Lyell, whose Principles of Geology, published 1830, was mentioned back in the film. Lyell's Principles of Geology in 1830, still to some extent a useful textbook for people to look at. It's a rather interesting book. When Lyell wrote, he just assumed this principle of uniformity. This is a basic principle. How did it get there? Present forces operating. Here's a sediment 50 feet thick made of fine mud. Let's go down and see how fast mud has been deposited in a lake. Well, it's been deposited a millimetre, it's been a tenth of an inch a year. Here's the thing 50 feet thick. Well, that means it must have taken 120 years to the foot and work it out, you see? Just like that. In the 19th century, a whole lot of people did that. Lord Raleigh, trying to estimate the age of the earth, said, well, the sea would have started with fresh water. The salt in the sea has come by erosion of the rocks. He measured the amount of salt being carried out to sea by a few rivers now. He estimated the total volume of river flow around the world and then worked out the age of the earth. He got a figure somewhere around about 30, 50 million years. It was nothing big enough for the evolutionists to play with, but still, that's the sort of figure he came up with. Another example. You want to estimate the age of the earth, you get a piece of, you find a deposit of uranium, it's turned into lead. You say, righto, it's decaying at a certain rate, it would have all started as uranium, see how much lead's there now, let's see how long it took to get there, for all that much to decay. See how the principle operates all the time? But the potential fallacy is, how do you know? There's no way on present evidence that you don't know that something different didn't happen in the past. Oh, it might have all been put there at a certain point as a going concern. A little bit like that puzzle you get when you go to some of those mining towns, the big near boom mining towns. You go to even a place like Blackwater. You drop through Blackwater. It's very hard to imagine there's no town there a few years ago. You tend to say, oh, well, it took a few years for a town like this to grow, and look, there's some nice shrubs growing in the garden. That would have taken a few years. Because what you don't realise is that the shrub probably came as a 7-foot plant brought in a great big tub from a florist place somewhere or another and dumped there, you know? See? Or you look at somebody who's living in their new house and you estimate the age of their house by the greenness of their lawn, but you're not aware of the interesting Brisbane phenomenon of selling turf instead of grass seed. Plenty of illustrations. You see that? Okay, you take my point. Now, where does Darwin fit into this? Darwin, if you like, has come in on this. Because in the mid-19th century, Darwin did for biology something the same that Hutton and Lyell did for geology, that Newton did for physics. The explanation of certain things in terms of presently known forces. Now, what sort of things did Darwin have? Well, he went around the world on his famous voyage on the Beagle, and he noticed the finches and the islands, etc., etc. What other experiments did he do? Well, back home in England, he grew a garden of weeds and saw which weeds choked out which other ones. And noticed the sort of, counted population changes in a bed of weeds. I mean, that's not very hard to do, is it? I mean, the nutgrass and my tomatoes are fighting a very interesting campaign at the moment, just on that question. If I was a Darwinian, I would say that at the moment the tomatoes don't seem to have much evolutionary advantage over the nutgrass, but anyway. Darwin's point, of course, is that same appeal. Notice the appeal. What are the basic questions? Two things that are identifiable. That there are changes. There are variations in a population. Right, first point. And secondly, there is some kind of a survival of the fittest going on. And there's no question about those two things. I mean, they do happen. I mean, populations do vary within themselves. There are variations within a population. And number two, it is true that there is a sort of a survival of the fittest thing going on. And if you understand it particularly in survival of the fittest as being a survival to reproduce, well, of course that's true. That's what probably would happen to my tomatoes if I didn't sort of intervene on their behalf. They may not survive to reproduce, except a very tough one that's awfully nutgrass resistant or something. Darwin's theory then was another one of these theories which set out to explain in terms of presently observable forces operating. And again, like all of these other theories, it rests on a couple of assumptions. The most important one being this assumption that human reason, aided by present observation, can give an ultimate explanation. You see, what happens is explanations start off as being an as-if explanation and eventually turn into a reality. They move from being if this is what happened, if this is all that could have happened, then it must have happened that way. I don't think we'd have any objection to somebody who tries that out as a theory, but it's when they say, and therefore this must have happened, they drop the as-if bit. All right, Darwin's theory, in a sense. Consequences of Darwin's theory are rather interesting, and again, I think Darwin's theory, rather like Newton's, although, as I said, Newton's didn't have quite the same crunch, has had certain consequences in reinforcing certain views about man and about man's place in nature. Darwin's theory is the notorious one. I rather suspect that it's a much longer tradition of what science can or can't do that's the real problem, not just what Darwin came up with. Three consequences of Darwin's theory, I think, are areas of concern and certainly areas of big influence. First of all, certainly, Darwin's influence on beliefs about origins. There's no question that Darwin had a very big influence on people's beliefs about the origins of life, and presumably, by some strange extension, origins of the world, the universe, of everything. You know, I think we tend to forget sometimes that in 1859, many people, were quite happy to go along with Genesis 1 as a literal account of how it got there. After 1859, there was certainly a very rapid crumbling of belief in the validity of the early chapters of Genesis. Now, I know that you can get around that and say, but many people read it not literally, but saw it as some sort of an allegory or as a poem or as a general statement of principle that God has created or something like that. But the fact remains that before 1859, not many people did worry about looking at it like that. Most people took it at face value. After 1859, quite a serious shift of thinking on that question. That's one. Number two, and this may even be more significant in the long run, Darwin also provided us with a view of man. The origin of species did not really come to grips with the origin of man, but he took that up in later books. A view of the nature of man. The theory, the point being that mankind has, after all, continuity with all other living things. Man is continuous, in a sense, with, well, not just the apes, but with all of living things. There's not some vast gap between the animals and man. They have a certain continuity. That's the second principle that comes out of Darwin's theory. And that one in the long run turned out to be very, very significant. A lot of people are not aware of the fact, but later in his life, Darwin wrote another book in the 1870s called The Expression of the Emotions in Animals and Men. And that book in many ways is probably just as significant as The Origin of Species. What he did there was to look at not so much physical structures, but behaviour in terms of its survival value. Right, so you can explain physical structures possibly in Darwin's theory. His original theory was an attempt to explain how certain physical structures had evolutionary, had adaptability advantages. In The Expression of the Emotions, he then moved to the question of behaviour type things. Why do we have certain behaviour traits? Have these, what, you know, have they got some evolutionary, some advantage? Do they give us some adaptability we wouldn't have otherwise? Example, lots of animals, you know, why do human beings have the ability to scowl and pull horrible faces? Where do you get that ability from? What's the good of it? See the question? The question is being asked in terms of his previous theory. The previous theory is assumed, and you now ask, what's the good of this expression? Well, you can explain it fairly easily, you know, cave times or something, I suppose. The saber-toothed tiger come in the cave, the person who can go very effectively had a better chance of survival, I don't know. And notice how he relates that. Of course, in that book he relates those sort of expressions of emotion in humans to expression of emotions in animals. You know, the apes that grimaces and snarls. Anybody who's seen films on the life of baboon colonies, the snarling and the throwing dust and dirt and sticks and garbage at anybody, anything that comes near their colony, you know, this is part of their, that's obviously part of their defensive mechanism. Well, you know, some of us have got past the stage of throwing dust and dirt and sticks, but we still scowl occasionally. See the argument? There's a continuity. You can explain one thing to the other. And this leads on to another point with the regard to the view of man. It leads on to a notion that a lot of experimentation, psychological discovery about animals will be very relevant to psychological discovery about human beings. Now I get worried about this one, because in the teacher training game we find that an awful lot of our evidence about classroom management, classroom behaviour, originates from somebody experimenting with pigeons or rats. Now there's something very odd about that. There's got to be something odd about that. It really has. Yeah? Somebody, you know, take B.F. Skinner, the Harvard fellow, the man who got the behaviour modification operant conditioning techniques. You put a rat in a box, and there's a button over in one corner. You want him to learn to press it. So first of all, when he just looks in the right direction, you throw a grain of wheat in or a piece of cheese. Oh, that's pretty good. So he looks that way again. Eventually, he's conditioned to look in that direction. Then you don't feed him for doing that. You wait till he takes a step towards the button, and then you condition him. You're dropping your bit of food and reward him again. And gradually, bit by bit, you lead him over to the point where every time he sort of feels he wants something to eat, he turns around and runs over to the button. And eventually, he presses it. And then if you're very careful the way in which you reward him, don't reward him every time, but reward him intermittently, randomly, you'll almost make the poor thing addicted to pressing the button. You know, you'll press it all day. They did it with pigeons, and they had pigeons that when they stopped rewarding them, they were so hooked on it they kept pecking away till the base of their beak got sore, and they had to take them out of the cage away from them. And of course you can generalise very quickly to human beings, can't you? I mean, there's a certain... I'm not sure whether you'd call it to do with a sport or entertainment. I guess it's something to do with entertainment. But a certain contraption that's banned in Queensland. That's a beautiful example of that. Yeah, the one-armed bandit. It's a beauty. Yeah? It'd be some lovely experiments done with the one-armed bandit like that. You know, you turn off the pay thing and some characters will put 810 cent bits in it before they stop. That's been done. Very, you can sort of move from one to the other very quickly. But notice what we've done even in that example. Notice how we've done the slide. It applies to the rat, it applies to the man. Straight across like that. It's been applied to principles of classroom management. You get a classroom full of really noisy, disturbed kids. So people have actually done this, gone into the room with a handful of jelly beans. There's kids rioting madly, and there's one kid's quiet for a second, and they're flicking the jelly bean. That reinforces the quietness a bit, and eventually you get them under control. I'm not quite sure what that does. The theory is if you can quieten them down to a certain point, you might even be able to talk to them and get them to, you know, see some reason for maintaining some sort of order in the place anyway. But it has been used as a technique, is it? And there's a whole string of applications of behaviour modification techniques to working with various sorts of psychiatric patients, with work with retarded children, all sorts of things. You know, there's been a whole mass of this sort of application. And we accept it. We blithely go along with it. We read that it works for rats and we go out and try it on kids. Now, it may well be that in some cases you can, of course. There's similarities. But the assumption of that sort of almost total continuity is a very, very strange assumption. And we know jolly well, if we think about it another way, that there are some differences between rats and human beings. You know the joke about the two rats in the Skinner box. One says to the other one, "Boy, I got that guy Skinner conditioned. Every time I press the button, he feeds me." You see, what makes that funny, or vaguely funny, is the fact that we don't normally think of rats thinking like that. Which draws attention, well, you know, the rat acting as a human, the rat thinking as Professor Skinner is considered to be very strange. You know, we find that rather odd. But it's quite interesting how we use the animal model very quickly in thinking about humans. And sometimes I wonder how far you can take it. I'm always wary about using models and taking them too far. You never know you're never quite sure whether your model necessarily squares up with the thing you're trying to imagine. There's certainly been some very strange suggestions about education. I mean, Skinner honestly suggested that one way to teach children efficiently would be to sit them in little booths with their own little videotape teaching machine, and the questions come up and they press the button, and he showed this is much more efficient than an ordinary classroom. You know, it's weird. They sit there, you've got no discipline problems because they get, you know, just the way they get hooked on television, or they get hooked on the little video screen and they answer the questions all day. It's weird. But of course, in the real world, we find that human beings are not quite like that. You know, kids will soon find ways of sitting in there wrecking the machine. They're sure to. Anybody doesn't believe in original sin, watch a class of schoolboys for 2 minutes, you'll see two original sins. And besides that, there's a whole lot of other things. You know, there's all sorts of interesting side effects. I mean, rats don't sort of have bad side effects from pressing a button. If you have a kid isolated from other kids for hours, you know, that's... Well, anyway, there's an assumption that there's a continuity in man and apes. The third assumption is an assumption about models for theory building. The evolutionary model has become almost the model for thinking about practically every aspect of development, of almost every aspect of human society or thought about something changing. If you wanted to write a history of rugby league in Brisbane, couldn't you write, you know, rugby league in Queensland, the evolution of a code? Wouldn't that be a possible title? The evolution of a code. Now, I mean, does that mean that all the alternatives sort of died out? Well, I suppose it does. They tried 16-a-side at one stage, didn't they? It got a bit messy, and they tried 11-a-side, and there wasn't enough jobs for professionals or something. But, you know, there have been some alternatives tried way back in the past. But you could write that, the evolution of a code. You know, and the assumption is the one that survived is the one that sort of somehow deserved to survive and the others have dropped it by the way. And that leads me then, from those three consequences, a belief about origins, a view of man, and a general model for what a theory about origins ought to look like. That's the three sorts of things. That brings me to three 20th century consequences of Darwin. One, consequence in ethics. An assumption that the organism, the thing, the behaviour that has the most survival value is the good. That the thing which gives you sort of some sort of competitive advantage is good. Somebody has commented that it's interesting that Darwin's theory came about just about the high tide of English capitalism. It's quite interesting. It's, you know, in a sense, it's almost an ultimate capitalistic competition model applied to the biological development of species. Huh? Very interesting. There's some other interesting consequences of the ethics. As a result of Darwin, certainly a great undermining of a belief in a God who created laws. Laws are, after all, in the Darwin model, and morals are seen as behaviour patterns which possibly have some sort of survival value, which enable the organisms to live, enables their society to adapt. So that means you've got no ultimate morality. Morality changes as social conditions change. And that leaves some very wide open questions about ethics. It's quite interesting to see that in the generation after Darwin, a lot of people didn't pick that. First of all, there was the view that society itself is somehow like a great organism which itself is developing. And there was a very optimistic view in the late 19th century. Many people were very optimistic, particularly in Britain. A great deal of optimism. We are progressing, we are learning more, we are getting better. Our society is becoming more humane, more tolerant. We are becoming a less cruel people, except out in the colonies where we shoot a few natives now and again. But, you know, we are basically becoming a better society. We are improving. The evolutionary development today is not of species, but of societies, and they are growing and improving. It's a kind of a Darwinian model of society almost. It became very popular. A very optimistic view. Things are going to get better. Things will improve. The good society today in the age of international trade and commerce is the one that, not the one that has wars and conquests and bloodshed, but the one that fits in well in the trading patterns and is successful financially and brings prosperity to its people. That's the society that will grow and deserves to grow, you see? A lot of people believe that. That was tied to a certain liberal sort of theology where the old views of sin and so on went down the drain to some extent, because after all, you know, human laws are a natural thing, and our laws, as our society changes, our laws are becoming better, more adaptable, more humane, our morality is improving, human beings' behaviour is improving, which is weird theory. Lots of people believed in it till 1914, but as Paul Tillich said, after the war, that sort of view of the world died in the mud of passion and heart. Well and truly. A second consequence, or a second sort of ethic thing, there was another strand over in Germany. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German, he picked more than anybody else. Nietzsche picked this, where this was heading. He said, look, God is dead. Your modern science, particularly the evolution bit at the finish, has killed off God. God is dead. Therefore, your values are dead. God is dead, your values are dead. No God, no ultimate morality. You can't live on the moral capital of the past. It's all right for Englishmen, sort of middle-class Englishmen, who sort of say, well, you know, there's the decent thing, old chap, you know, play up and play the game and all that sort of thing. That's all right. But they're living on a capital of the past. There's no reason for you to play up and play the game anymore. There's no reason for you to be a decent chap anymore. There's no God. There's no notion of what a decent chap is even anymore. Your God is dead. Your morals are dead. You're going to have to build your own morality. The human being who's going to live in this new world with no God and no absolute morals is going to have to be stronger, tougher, more morally sort of hard than anybody ever's been before. You're going to have to, you know, you're really going to have to battle to survive in this new world. Because in this new world, you're going to have to be capable of building your own morality. Pick your own values and stick to them. And somebody says, why are you doing it that way? Why do you believe that as a moral good? You say, well, I'm going to believe it anyway. You can't appeal to God. You can't appeal to anything. You can just say, well, that's the way I'm going to do it and I'm going to hold to it. So Nietzsche, in one of his books, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, talked about the age of the superman, the new man that would be required, the one who would be morally tough enough to make his own decisions and stick to them. It's the beginnings of modern existentialism. The view that you've got to carve your own morals, there's nobody to help you, there's no guides, there's no laws, there's no anything. You have to decide how you're going to live and take responsibility for it. That's ethics. The killing of ethical absolutes. Second consequence of Darwinian thinking. political and social theories. German biologist towards the end of the 19th century, Haeckel, would be a good example. The view that evolution indicates the struggle for survival. The moral good, the morally good, is that which manages to survive. The good is that which has survived. That's all. And so, life is a struggle. Organisms must struggle to survive. Those that don't struggle, or who struggle ineffectively, go down. And that is the good. That's all for the good. You know, sort of 1,000 will fall and 1 will grow. Well, that's good. That's the way, that's natural. That's the way it happens. That, a few years later, was enshrined in slightly different words. Written in 1923, man is a fighting animal. The man or the state that gives up the struggle to exist gives up the right to exist. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf. See how it can become that? Yeah? That's one possible interpretation of the whole thing, isn't it? You know, if it's a struggle for survival, and if there's no, and if morality is a matter of adaptability, well, the good morality is the one that helps you to struggle and survive. Full stop. I suppose, in retrospect, you could say that Hitler made a mistake. His morality didn't have survival value. The 1,000-year Reich lasted 12 years. It's interesting, though, to notice that in political and social theories, how there's that assumption of evolution runs through most of our thinking. We talk about primitive societies. What do we mean by a primitive society? One that hasn't evolved as far as we have yet. The attitude towards the Aboriginal communities in Australia. 60, 70 years ago, the normal attitude towards Aborigines was, well, you know, they're a primitive people and they're dying out. They can't cope with the modern world, they're going to die out. And the few that's left will assimilate. You know, the growth of the great assimilation leagues. Remember the assimilation leagues? To help assimilate the people? Very powerful in some parts of the country. The idea being that, you know, they're a primitive people, they can't cope. They're less developed than we are. Maybe not as individuals, but their society is less developed than we are. They can't cope. Notice how today there's another view. It's also related to another Darwinian model, the model of the continuity of man, the animals, etc. A certain sort of moralising about Aboriginal land rights and Aboriginal communities now, which, rather than treating them as a primitive and therefore deserving to die out, which is the older view, now tends to see them as a variant species of society which ought to be preserved. And in fact, there's a very interesting correlation now, and it's one of the most vicious forms of paternalism we've ever come up with, which tends to relate conservation of gum trees and rainforests with conservation of Aboriginal tribes. We will conserve some rainforests, some kangaroos and some Aboriginals in their native state. Nobody's ever quite put it in one sentence, but I tell you what, you listen to some of the rhetoric. What about the girl in the traditional tribe who decides she doesn't want to be married to the 75-year-old tribal elder at the age of 12 and who shoots through to seek the protection of white man's society? There's been some good hassles of that in the past in the Northern Territory and North Queensland. How is that one going to be answered by the people who run this new view? Is she going to be treated as a human being with her own rights? Or is she going to be treated as part of the tribe which she must conserve? It's going to be very interesting to see how that's treated in the future. The continuity of man and everything else, you know? Because one of the things that this does, it blurs out the individual. The individual is nothing, it's the survival of the species that counts, you see? Third influence, third consequence, ethics, political and social theories, the third one is theology. You can see that same view about the difference between primitive and complex societies coming out last century with the scholars who started to wrestle with the early books of the Old Testament, the people who tried to work out the correct order in which they were written, whatever that might be. The people who tried to work out who wrote which bits of which. The sort of assumption goes this way. Look at Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy refers to a very complex society, a very complex social order. Couldn't have possibly meant a thing to pastoral nomads. It couldn't have meant a thing to a simple peasant society, and it would need a fairly complex state like a Greco-Roman state to make any sense for a whole moral system like that. Therefore, it must have been written not 1300 BC or whenever the Exodus was, it must have been written probably 600, 700 BC at a time when there's a complex state. Therefore, it's a forgery put under the name of Moses or Joshua or whatever so that it's got ancient authority. Bang. Finished. And the rise of all of those endless theories. I mean, you read, if you get a thing like R.K. Harrison's Introduction to the Old Testament, look at the first chapter where he talks about the history, very very quick summary, it's a bit summary, he talks about the history of different views of the Pentateuch, that's the first five books of the Bible. It's incredible, you know, all these different theories. And the one that emerged out of it, the Graaff-Wellhausen hypothesis, based mainly on the work of Julius Wellhausen, who was pretty convinced that some bits were too complex to be related to a primitive society. The assumption being that people in 1300 BC were more primitive, their societies hadn't evolved as far. That's the basic underlying thought, you see? It's just there. He doesn't say that, but that's what he means. That's where it's come from. And of course today we know that there were societies in 1300 BC in Palestine probably as complex socially as ours. The Hittites. And people who've got working in Hittite language and literature, you know, have made enormous discoveries about the complexity of their system. It was as complicated as the Roman system, at least. And even other work on people who are even more closely related to the Hebrews, the work that's been done on the excavations on the, you know, the Ugaritic towns, El Shama. Incredible. You know, the detail has been discovered about early societies. So that assumption about... But nevertheless, that assumption... That Darwinian assumption that there is a development, an evolution, if you like, of societies, is sort of with us. What I'm trying to get at is those assumptions are just so deeply ground within us that when we come back to look at Darwin's theory, one of the reasons why we find his theory, or many people find his theory so hard to even question for a minute, is that it's built into the very framework of our whole thinking. About so many things. The evolution of the football code, the primitive society to the more complex society, the evolution of this, the something of that, all fits into the same pattern. And secondly, we've also, not from Darwin, but from the ancient Greeks and from Newton and from Galileo and from everybody in between, this long assumption that an explanation in terms of presently known and operating forces can be an ultimate explanation. That when you walk in and look at the billiard table and say, his last shot must have been, that can in fact be an ultimate explanation. And that seems to me a very dubious question, to say the least. A very dubious question indeed. Because we are neglecting that certain assumptions are being made. The assumption, the uniformitarian assumption, the only forces operating in the past are the same as now. So, what I think of, I hope this has not been too confusing. Let me just summarise very quickly. First of all, I talked about the basis of philosophy, the way in which philosophy seems to have had this long thread of assumption that man's mind can be the measure of all things. And I showed how, for instance, in the 18th century, about the time that the modern sciences were really becoming established, there was this almost hyper-confidence in the power of human reason. I then went back a little bit to look at Newton and the model of what a scientific theory would be like. And for the last 300 years, Newton's been taken very much as the model, the ideal, what a theory ought to look like. I showed how this same sort of model was absorbed into geology, and picked up in biology by people like Darwin. Remembering, of course, there were 100 people 100 years before Darwin. Even Darwin's grandfather got involved, was in the act back in the 18th century, old Erasmus Darwin. But still, Charles Darwin's the one we think of. And then I tried to show how the consequences of these assumptions, first of all, the immediate consequences of Darwin's theory, a belief about origins, a view of man, and a model for theory building. And then I tried to track into the 20th century some consequences of this sort of thinking, first of all in ethics, then in political and social theories, and finally in theology, and I've suggested that these ideas permeate, they underlie so much of our thinking, So when we go to ask questions about Darwin, it's not so much Darwin's theories, the facts, those debates. That's not where the real point is. The real point is much more of a philosophical question about what are the limits of the sort of science that you can do this way anyway, because I think we've assumed a whole lot of things. And it's those basic assumptions, the assumption that man's mind can reason successfully to ultimate answers, the assumption that from present operating things we can discover real truth about the past, and, if you like, finally, the assumption that there's something, that this evolutionary model is the model which explains how most changes have occurred through the ages. It's those sorts of assumptions that are the ones we should really be looking at. And I think they are much more important in the long run than worrying about a particular bit of evidence, because we will find that particular bits of factual evidence will always fit into half a dozen different theories. It's much more important to look at why we find one theory more attractive than another one.